I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is Spy Talk. Well, we're going to be talking in a few minutes about the Trump administration's move on Venezuela with Doug Farah, a leading expert on both Latin America and transnational crime syndicates. You could read that as Trendagua around the globe. But first, there's a few other things, as usual, in our corner of the national security world worth bringing up today. For me, one is what Russia's doing in Europe. A BBC documentary last week put a finger on it. Vladimir Putin's Russia is conducting a war on NATO. I'm not sure Americans, including especially Republican leaders in Congress, have a full understanding of the broad array of sabotage and espionage operations that the Russians are conducting, and now also including drone overflights of NATO territories. They're testing. They're pushing. This is war. And we got to understand and get our hands around it. That's my pet peeve of the week.
But not military action that implicates Article 5 of NATO?
That's right. They're keeping it at a low level, a low boil, so it does not provoke an Article 5 invocation. And, you know, we're not talking about sending tanks and missiles into Europe and having a kinetic war, a general war breakout with Russia, but being more muscular in our responses to the subversion activities that the Russians are conducting across Europe.
Well, just remember, you know, last year we had Chris Costa from the Spy Museum, who also was in the National Security Council under the first Trump administration. And he argues that Russia should be declared a terrorist state. And we should view it as a state sponsor of terrorism based on the very sort of sabotage actions they've been conducting in Europe.
They are at war in Ukraine. They're about to make a breakthrough in the Donbas, I just read this morning. Ukraine, in my view, is fighting for us. We're fighting for Western values in the Western alliance or NATO alliance. So I think this is a mortal threat to our national security in the long run, maybe even the more immediate run. And that's bothering me that it hasn't gotten sufficient attention here in the U.S.
I'd be careful. I think we need to be careful a little bit about how we use the word terrorism, which we seem to apply to every type of international conflict, be it, you know, the boats in Venezuela, whether it be the borders in Europe, etc. And I think it takes away from the idea of what it means to ramp up to war, to put it in this category of terrorism.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
What's on your mind, Mike?
Well, I did write a piece for Spy Talk this week about the continuing flights that Kash Patel, the director of the FBI, is using for personal trips last week to see his girlfriend sing the national anthem at a wrestling match in State College, Pennsylvania. Then he goes on the FBI aircraft to Nashville to presumably celebrate her birthday. There have been reports of a Scotland golfing trip with a bunch of buddies, courtesy of FBI aircraft. Of course, earlier in this year, he took the FBI plane to go see a hockey game in New York. And I pointed out that this sort of misuse of FBI aircraft led to the firing of an earlier FBI director, yeah, William Sessions. And he was fired by Bill Clinton. And the bill of particulars included misuse of FBI aircraft for personal reasons, flying to San Francisco to see his daughter, flying to Atlantic City with his wife to see a ballet performance. So the question is, were any of these flights approved by legal or ethics officials at the FBI? And per, it is true that FBI directors have to use FBI aircraft when, yeah, traveling for official or personal business, but they have to reimburse the government for the personal travel. Has Patel done that? We've asked the FBI questions about that and have gotten no answers.
Plus, he lives part-time in Las Vegas, which is, yeah, unusual for an FBI director, to say the, yeah, least, of all cities in the world he would pick. I guess his girlfriend is here. Anyway, right. I also want to ask you, what's happening on your on the front of your other report that got a lot of eyebrows raised, but that's all so far. What's happened to the White House bunker?
Good question. We're still waiting for answers on that as well.
It used to be under the East Wing. The East Wing is gone.
Have made clear the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, which is the emergency bunker the president is supposed to go to in the event of any sort of threat to the White House, was underneath the East Wing. The East Wing is gone. So is the bunker still there? How do you get there?
Is there America wants to know, where's the White House bunker?
All right, Karen had something before we get to our great discussion with Doug Farrar.
Okay, mine is very short and sweet and a lot more uplifting than what you guys are thinking about. So
maybe,
per usual. Yeah, maybe, exactly. I'm trying to make it that way. In the elections this week, two women, Abigail Spanberger and Mikey Sherrill, were elected to be governors of their states, Virginia and New Jersey, respectively. I think it's really significant that Abigail Spanberger became the governor of Virginia, not just because she was the first woman governor to be elected in Virginia, but after all these years, but also because of her CIA background. We had a guest on last week, Gina Bennett, who is well known for her books, National Security Mom 1 and National Security Mom 2. I think this idea of national security women going into actual politics and trying to say, here's what we've learned, who live in the bigger world, who understand the bigger threats, but also take them at the local level very, very personally, is important. And I want to see, you know, where this goes, if we see a kind of trend in this direction, and if we do, what it will entail. And I think it's a very it's kind of a watershed moment, and I'm looking forward to more of it.
It's a great development. I recycled our interview that we did last year with Abigail Spanberger, and I asked him, what's the difference between dealing with ISIS and Al Qaeda and MAGA Republicans in Congress? And besides the joke quotient there, she said, you know, the values that you have to learn as a case officer in the field, empathy, understanding the other person's and what their motivation is, finding common ground to work on, are very valuable skills in politics. And so people who have that ground experience as case officers, agent recruiters, spy recruiters in the CIA, have those skills.
Especially when they're female.
Okay. All right. I'm not going to object. So,
no arguments here.
Anyway, so yeah, that's great. And it needs to be remarked on and celebrated. Anyway, so I want to talk a little bit about our guest, Doug Farrar. I first knew Doug some 40 years ago. That's how old I am. When I was a foreign news editor at United Press International, he was our correspondent covering the wars in Central America. He He went on to a distinguished journalism career with the Washington Post and Newsweek and writing books, but he also carved out a specialty in transnational criminal organizations, such as the so-called blood diamonds trade in Africa. We could also say that he knows Latin America like the back of his hand, because he was actually born in Bolivia and spent much of his earlier years on the continent. He's been in and out of the continent for decades now. The Pentagon even called on his expertise and actually invited him to participate in a war game targeting Venezuela, which we're going to talk about. So without further ado, here's Doug Farah. Doug Farah, welcome to Spy Talk. You are the perfect guest today to talk about Venezuela. You're not only a longtime expert on South America, Latin America, but you're an expert, a recognized expert. You've testified before Congress on transnational crime. So that puts you in a perfect space, I think, to ask, what is this stuff with Venezuela all about?
Well, thank you, Jeff and Michael and Karen. Always good to see you. Some old friends from a long time ago.
Likewise.
Venezuela, what's it all about? Well, I think, you know, Venezuela has become a, without a doubt, a haven for multiple criminal groups to operate, including the former FARC groups that from the Colombian conflict to the FARC dissident groups, the ELN, their own criminal syndicates. But what Venezuela is not is a major producer of drugs. It has been a transshipment point for a long time under state protection, and it's been a sort of free, safe haven for other groups who want to operate, including occasionally the Iranians and others. But it is not a country that is either moving fentanyl to the United States in significant quantities or a producer of cocaine. Without a doubt, cocaine transits through there and it moves from Colombia across there. But most of the cocaine we're seeing now, one of the biggest changes in the drug market in the last few years, is the enormous rise of consumption in Europe and a significant stabilization or dropping of consumption in the United States. That's partly because prices are so much higher in Europe. So why is business enterprises, cartels look for maximum profits? It's about $17,000 a kilo for cocaine in Miami. It's $30,000 in Spain. The further in you go, the higher it gets. Former Soviet republics is over $70,000. Australia and New Zealand reached $250,000 a kilo a while back. It's now dropped back down to about $150,000. But if you're looking at market forces, and this is pure capitalism, the United States is not your primary market any longer, your most favorable market. So all of figuration around this is based on false premises.
So is Trump either ignorant or is he doing, he's threatening to overthrow Maduro for some other reason?
It's hard to tell. I mean, I think that clearly he lost a lot of support in the Latin community when he revoked the temporary protected status of Cubans and Venezuelans and Nicaraguans, sort of the nucleus of the folks that voted for him on the Latino side in his election cycles. And I think this is partly a way to try to win back those groups who believe that a military overthrow of Maduro would be a solution of some sort to their problems. I think there's also a misunderstanding, maybe genuine, I don't know, of what the role Venezuela actually plays. You can see it in how they talk about Tren de Aragua, which is definitely an unpleasant and very nasty group of people, but not doing what this administration says it is. So I think there are a series of false suppositions undergirding the current policy.
So, Doug, I was struck when we spoke the other day about the war scenarios that you engaged in during the prior Biden administration with the Pentagon. Because we don't know exactly what Trump has in mind here. The New York Times reported the other day they're considering direct attacks on military units that protect Maduro, possibly seizing the country's oil fields, other steps basically designed to force Maduro from power. The question is, what happens the day after? And if I understood you correctly, that's exactly what you were examining in these war scenarios that you were, or war games you were participating in with the Pentagon. So tell us a little what these exercises were and what the conclusions were.
Well, the exercise is actually, I was working with the Pentagon as a contractor for the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Counter-Narcotics and Global Threats through part of Obama and through Trump one into Biden. And then throughout that time, there were multiple scenarios run in which I participated as a subject matter expert, along with sort of the interagency community. And the question was, as you said, what does a day after Maduro look like? And so if you look at the possibility of going in militarily or trying to overthrow him, overthrow the Maduro regime. Now, if you just get rid of Maduro, let's say this whole thing implodes, then you have a military that has no loyalty, no command and control structure, and they're armed and out in the field doing essentially whatever they want. You have no police structure that will be loyal to the new government coming in. What we were looking at was premised on someone like at the time Juan Guaido coming in as president who had won those elections, or now I guess it'd be Maria Cortina coming in as the winner. So you'd have a new government with no intelligence structures because all the intelligence is run out of Cuba, no military, no police, and then you have a significant presence of multiple thousands of FARC dissident guerrillas in the key areas that control gold production. So you're looking at a group that's fought a civil war in Colombia and then migrated around for more than 60 years. And you have the presence of the ELN guerrillas now also out of Colombia, in and around ports and taking over multiple illicit economies that have also been fighting for 60 years. So you have multiple factors of groups where you have no possibility of territorial control, and you're going to have a very fragmented, very violent thing.
That was chaos.
Chaos, exactly, for a sustained period of time with no possibility of ending it. I mean, how? And the other factor in all of this time when I was doing this was the thinking was the U.S. would have Colombia to backstop a lot of what it was doing. We don't have that anymore. Colombia's gone, is a U.S. ally. So it's even worse now. The other option was to try to, Jesus. That we looked at was sort of just try to do what Trump one did, what Biden did, a little bit of what Obama did, put enough economic pressure on the regime so the regime itself has to transition out. In other words, Maduro can't survive, but you end up with some sort of government in a transition process toward one would hope eventually elections in a less authoritarian dictatorial regime that then would have some margin of independence from Iran and other groups. And that was the scenario that would have the least violence, because you would, in theory, have a government still in control with a command and control structure over a military. The military is entirely designed to protect the regime. It's not designed to fight an external attacker. You know, what you see across the region, we did studies on the Cartel de los Soles for the government when I was working there, and they rotate every 6 months among the key financial hubs of the regime. So you're 6 months as head of Puerto Cabello because you can make a ton of money there. But they don't want you there for too long so you don't develop a base of support. They don't want you to become too popular, guys like you. So 6 months later, you might rotate to be vice president of the country. And then you'll rotate to be head of the airport. And then you'll rotate to be head of one of the key economic zones that produces gold. Any place where all of these groups can rotate and make money, but you can't build a base of support. So you're not looking at a military designed to fight an external threat. You're looking at a regime that's designed to protect its own and repress its own people.
So let me jump in here for a second and just talk about, just to riff off of what you were just saying. I mean, there is an international context around this, and you've written and spoken about this, which is that where do the great powers come in on this? And is there a role? This is kind of a two-phase question. Is there a role for international organizations? You name them, there are a number that are about the, you know, Latin America, South America, to play a role in sort of helping either for a transition or helping to break away some of the great power allies that are helping Venezuela and that we've seen help Venezuela in recent years.
Well, I think if you're talking about great powers actually engaging with Venezuela, the only one really doing that is China, because they have a significant debt issue with China that Venezuela they would like to come out with something, right? They don't want to lose billions of dollars in regime change there.
Now, are you saying that China owes Venezuela billions of dollars?
No, Venezuela owes China. A lot of them were oil for product deals, and of course, Venezuelan oil production plummeted, and they haven't been able to pay that debt. Russia can't engage with them significantly. They're engaged in a war in Ukraine. They have multiple other problems. So the idea of Russia riding to the rescue is fairly preposterous, and they don't have any money to give them. Like, what can you get? You can give them some IGLA surface-to-air missiles, which they may or may not have done. Maduro says they gave them 5,000. The Iranian drones could be a significant factor if there were an actual confrontation. Iran is not a global superpower. They like Venezuela as a rest and relaxation and logistics hub. So the only sort of superpower, global power, are the United States and China that we're talking about in this particular scenario. I don't think China has any desire for conflict at the region. Their entire premise in Latin America, which runs counter to what the Russians want, is stability. The Russians want instability, chaos for the United States, etc. China wants stability. So, you know, they would probably like to work to make this a non-violent, non-disruptive transfer. Then when you look at the regional groups, you really got nobody that has any game, right? You have the OAS, which has proved to be particularly, I would say, useless in recent years. You have the UN, where the US and Russia and China's vetoes can cancel each other out. Mm-hmm. And you have CELAC, which was the regional institution set up by Chavez to former President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela to exclude the United States and Canada, but all the rest of Latin America is there. But that hasn't really worked. And you have BRICS, which is the other, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, but they're much more economic focused. So it's a long way of saying there are really no multilateral bodies that can engage in any significant way. You may have someone like President Lula of Brazil, who would very much like to avoid a confrontation, who can talk to Maduro and may still be able to talk to Trump. Trump has been insulting him regularly for the last few months. So there are leaders. I would say the socialist government in Uruguay, Boric in Chile, the socialists in Chile, have lines of communication with Maduro that others don't have, but I'm not sure they can actually persuade anything to happen there.
So what does that mean in terms of empowering Maduro and in terms of your scenario of this sort of total chaos? Did it mean the status quo is mostly like, what's your prediction of what's actually going to happen, given that there's no multilateral context that can help in the present situation or in the future situation?
Well, I think the big question is that always is in these situations with authoritarian regimes that have been incredibly abusive of their own people is, do you find a way for them to go into exile where they can live peacefully the rest of their lives, or do you try to bring them to trial? And that, I think, is the calculation in people like Maduro's brain. Does he want to stand trial for human rights abuses, et cetera? Or do you just say, look, take some money, go to Russia, live happily ever after, and let's move on. The problem with either of those scenarios is that you have an entire architecture of the regime that depends on the distribution system that exists. It's a very sort of crazy balance among different interest groups. You have the Estado Cabello. You had for a while Tariq al-Islami, who's no longer there, but his culture, his clan group is still sort of there. You have the military itself, and they're divided into different officer classes, etc. So how to transition from that into something that is more democratic is very difficult. I think that eventually, and everyone has failed to, all administrations have failed to bring enough economic pressure to break the small amount of money the regime needs to survive. I was a big proponent when I was talking to people of declaring PDVSA, the state oil company, sanctioning the PDVSA state oil company that generated most of their revenue. Mm-hmm. And they did it. Trump one did it. And it had essentially very little effect, right? There are so many holes in the sanctions regimes between being able to operate with Iran, China, Russia, India. You know, there's a whole sector of the world that doesn't care about our sanctions anymore. And so these sanctions become less and less effective. So that's not an option. So I think that either you have to raise the cost in real terms of economic, like they have tons of investment. We mapped them out in my projects with the Pentagon. We mapped out lots of investments in the U.S. that have never been touched. If you really want to go after the Maduro regime, there are many, many economic factors left you can pull the levers on. Other than that, I don't think he's going anywhere.
Is there another strongman, a military guy who could step in?
Well, you have Diosdado Cabello, who's the head of the comes out of the military. I think he's had so many different posts. I think he's currently head of the Congress, but he holds multiple. He's the actual power of the behind the military loyalty to Maduro. You have Delcy Rodriguez and the Rodriguez brothers, who are very very influential now. No one has any popularity in Venezuela. Like, there's no person behind the scenes is actually much more popular than Maduro. Maduro is not popular. Diosdado is not popular. Jorge Rodriguez is not popular. So there's no one who can step in as the charismatic savior. What you would need is probably someone like maybe Diosdado, who has a lot of blood on his hands, and people would be very unhappy about this. And I'm not saying this is a good solution, but a solution to a stable transition would be have somebody around like Diosdado who can control the military or talk to the military while moving to a different scenario. But there's no one waiting in the wings that would just ride in.
So, Doug, if in fact the administration is considering direct attacks on military units that protect Maduro, that's obviously an action by the U.S. military. I believe you told me that in those war scenarios you were participating in, you looked at the introduction of U.S. military into Venezuela, presumably to keep the peace after the overthrow of Maduro and his regime. What did you find about how many U.S. military boots on the ground would be needed to perform, and under what circumstances they would be introduced into Venezuela?
The short answer is a lot. I mean, you're looking at controlling, in the best case scenario, Caracas, and you'd need the airports in one of the main ports as to sort of have a minimally functioning occupation. I don't know if you remember, Michael, I was the Washington Post correspondent in Haiti when the U.S. occupied Haiti in 1992. And that was a relatively enormous undertaking for a very small country that had no jungle and no other armed groups there. So to go into a country and hope to establish territorial control writ large would be probably impossible for what the U.S. has a tolerance for and what it would really want to do. I think what is realistic in the current scenario is for the Trump administration to decide to bomb a few key ports like Puerto Cabello, which is a deeply criminalized port. A lot of drugs leave from there. But it's also that they're also near refineries. It depends on how much civilian infrastructure pain you want to inflict. If you're going to hope for economic reactivation, you want to blow up their oil refineries and then have them out of commission. Probably not. Could you blow up Puerto Cabello as a shipping structure that limits cocaine trafficking? Probably. But then you're also destroying their ability to import food. And you want a hunger crisis that will drive further migration. We already have 3.8 million Venezuelans who have migrated out and caused chaos across the region and in the United States. So there's everything has a significant trade-off. Leaving him there has a trade-off. Doing anything relatively effective to move him out means the recuperation time will be that much longer.
So when you said, in answer to my first question, a lot of U.S. military, give us a number. What did you find as what would be needed? Are we talking several hundred, several thousand? What are we talking about?
Well, we didn't actually go into like deciding like what a deployment of forces would look like. We were trying to decide what was in my little group. I wasn't part of the like what a military deployment would look like. So I don't want to falsely portray what we were looking at. We were looking at what you would need minimally to establish a functioning government. And that would mean territorial control. It's not too dissimilar to Syria. You need control of Damascus and some of the key economic nodes, and then the rest of the country sort of goes to hell. And that would probably be what would happen in Venezuela. You could probably take Puerto Cabello, the main airports, Caracas, maybe a secondary city. But are you going to go into the hinterlands of the Colombian border where you're going to face 3,000 or 4,000 heavily armed FARC dissidents who have been fighting for 60 years? Probably not. It doesn't. Right. And there's no easy targets there. I mean, what they're doing is digging up, cutting down the jungle, poisoning with mercury, and taking out gold. You don't have a lot of targets there. You know, what are you going to do? Blow up? Both you and Jeff, I don't know what your background is, Karen, but know from your counter-narcotics days, you can blow up an airstrip in the middle of the jungle, and 15 minutes later, they have a bulldozer that has patched up whatever you've done. So you want to spend $3 million on a missile to build a hole that's going to be repaired? Yeah, you can, or you can chase little go-fast boats around the Caribbean that are carrying small quantities. Does that materially impact anything? No.
So minimally, to for the minimal mission of taking Caracas and securing, what are we talking? How many military troops?
We, like I say, we didn't talk numbers. It would be thousands, without a doubt, because you'd need
thousands.
Oh, certainly, probably tens of thousands, because you'd have
tens
to have
of thousands of U.S. boots on the ground.
Well, you're talking a capital city of several million people. You're talking ports that would need to be protected. I don't know how many ultimately went into Haiti, but it was well over 10,000, and that was a tiny little half an island with no.
Imagine armies. Occupying Manhattan.
Yeah, it's just so.
Wait, let's contain this.
Yeah. Okay, it's time for a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Doug about the prospects for covert action in Venezuela.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media.
And we're back.
Let's talk covert action. We published a piece yesterday talking about all the problems and challenges of covert action. We went back to Iran and used that as sort of a template, which was considered a big success. One of the options in covert action, of course, the quick option would be to get, you know, some general to overthrow Maduro. I've already sort of approached this question. I suppose there's a lot of people for sale in Venezuela now, given Maduro's overall unpopularity. Would you agree with that, by the way, is that there are a lot of people for sale, a lot of generals who would be eager to take the CIA's money and take over?
I would say probably. I think we have had so many military defections over the years, and the attempt to get Maduro's pilot to switch sides didn't work out so well. I think right
his
now,
pilot,
yeah, the AP I think had a big story a couple of days ago about trying to buy Maduro's pilot to get him to drop him in a place where they could extradite him from, as opposed to going to wherever he is supposed to be going. I think right now they're in a state of high paranoia. I think they have really good Venezuelan counterintelligence working with them to minimize those possibilities. And I think you have a long history of people like El Pollo Carvajal, General Carvajal, who is deeply involved in the drug trade with the FARC in the war, goes to Spain and then tries to spill his guts and eventually ends up on trial and in a U.S. jail. So that didn't go so well for some of the folks who have thought they could cut deals. Now, in this scenario, could it be different? Yes. I think that you probably have generals who are quite nervous about what could possibly happen to them. And I think that, you know, but I think my sense has been over time that we have very little reliable intelligence coming out of Venezuela now because they've really locked down. And, you know, for however small it is, Cuba is very good at counterintelligence, as we've seen through the years. They had, you know, people in our system for 30 years we didn't discover. And the Castro regime and post-Castro regime have survived, which means they're really, really good at what they do. So mm-hmm. I think that it would be tough, not impossible.
But what about the general threat to the region? You know, what's going to happen in the region? I mean, we mentioned the severing of an alliance with Colombia, right? Recently, we've heard utterances about Cuba. The question is, you know, A, what's the end goal? You know, is this the reversal of the what began as the Monroe Doctrine and changed so rapidly, you know, over the years? What's the regional sense of how far you think, from your work at Wargaming, et cetera, that what's the ultimate goal here in terms of the United States? Is it really about Venezuela and Maduro? Is it about something bigger regionally? And if so, what's that about?
I don't know, is the short answer. I think, you know, what you have in the region is a deep dislike, even among folks who would generally have been aligned with at least Chavez in the early days of the Bolivarian Revolution, now very, very angry with him. I think what is grossly misunderstood outside the region is how deeply, deeply damaging and convulsive having 3.8 million refugees leave and spread across the region and destabilize Chile, destabilize Ecuador, destabilize Colombia, destabilize Peru, all the way down to Argentina. You have hundreds of thousands of people arriving that these countries then had to absorb with very little international aid. Then you, in those diasporas, which were largely not criminal, you had groups like Tren de Aragua moving out and creating criminalized communities, et cetera. So the impact on the fabric of Latin American democracy and societies have already been deeply, deeply damaged by what's the Venezuela situation. And I think in looking at what happens now, that is one of the foremost things in Latin Americans' minds. Oh my God, what happens if we have another 3 million Venezuelans? Because they simply can't take it. You know, with strong sort of democratic governments like Chile, you suddenly have 800,000 Chilean Venezuelans showing up. You have a policy of having to feed and house and give medical care to refugees when they come in. So their entire fabric was demolished overnight, trying to deal with their legal requirement to deal with these people humanely and trying to deal with their own people. And they failed. You know, Boric is now tremendously unpopular. Ecuador, part of the deep chaos and violence in Ecuador, is because their system was so strained they couldn't deal with it, and boom, everything explodes. And now they have the highest homicide rate in the world. So there are multiple issues that I don't get any sense that this administration is thinking about not because they like Maduro, because they're terrified of the results of what will happen in a post-Maduro regime. What, are we going to go in and control the border with Colombia and Guyana? I doubt it. You know, I don't think we're going to station 30,000 troops on that border, on those borders, to slow it down. So that's the impetus for groups to begin to say, wait, 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 wait. Okay, we don't like Venezuela. Yes, they're maybe drug trafficking. Okay, but my God, you're going to destroy us even further.
So, Doug, that said, what would be a smart policy for the United States?
I think that there are ways, including, I mean, we had identified in our work in the Pentagon and numerous, I mean, many financial avenues of sanctions busting that the regime was using at the time and they were never really undertaken. It was complicated. It was too much work. Do you want to bring a case for this or that? There are many things, especially if you're going to now use the terrorist designation, do things to go after their financial flows, which I think is really the lifeblood.
So how would you do that? Be a little granular.
I think you could map out, and I think we have mapped out to a degree, where literally billions of dollars are across Europe, offshores, and in the Caribbean, offshore, and in other parts of Europe, Liechtenstein, other places, Panama, and the United States. The United States has a huge amount of Venezuelan money here. So I would first go after that. I think that what you have to, because China's not going to give them much money, and Russia can't give them money if they wanted to. So they don't have a lot of.
Are these offshore accounts of regime principals like Maduro himself and his top aides, or are they just Venezuelans who happen to have offshore accounts?
It's tons of money that flows through PDVSA, the oil company. I mean, in one case, very small case, I spent way too much time on when I was doing this. Well, two cases, Nicaragua and El Salvador. They both had subsidiaries of PDVSA. PDVSA laundered $3 billion in a six-year period through El Salvador's subsidiary of PDVSA. That we could document that. That was much smaller than the amount that was moving through Nicaragua. And that was probably at least $10 billion, probably more. There was a whole other system called Alba Africa, which was moving billions of dollars of oil, triangulating it through Ivory Coast and in Libya at the time.
Where does it go?
As far as I could trace it, we got it to the offshore accounts in different BVI and elsewhere, and then it disappears. A lot of it is now going to Hong Kong because the Chinese are willing to protect it if it gets there. They don't transport it themselves, but if you're there, you're a safe haven. Russia, people don't really like to move money to Russia because rubles aren't very convertible, but the yuan is now. And it's outside of the U.S. SWIFT system. There are multiple advantages. So there are is harder now than it was 5 years ago to go after money because there are too many. There's so many. And you have Bitcoin now, you're crypto now, which also opens up a whole world of possibilities. So I think that I don't think bringing the regime crashing down and causing chaos and mass exodus is going to benefit anyone. How to avoid that through serious negotiations. I know Trump has said that they have, you know, been offered everything by Venezuela to not invade. I think if there were serious negotiations about, and I'm not personally, I don't think this is the way foreign policy should be done, but in this transactional administration, oil access in exchange for regime change or soft transition of the regime out. I think in all of this now, you're at a point where you're probably going to have to say, okay, Maduro will never be tried for crimes against humanity. Diosdado probably won't be.
He remains a indicted drug trafficker in the United States, right?
Yes, he does. As does Diosdado, as does most of the leadership. Mm-hmm. Delcy, the vice president, does. And, you know, they all have outstanding criminal cases in the U.S. or indictments in the U.S.
So can we just look the other way?
That's the question. I mean, it's a terrible price. I have no
Let me ask this question. You know, in terms of all the change within the Trump administration in these even recent days, how do you assess the capacity within the executive to understand the complexity of this problem, understand the fallout, should there be, you know, a Maduro, you know, forced out of power one way or another?
Is anybody smart in the top of this administration?
I don't deal with this administration at all, so I really don't know. I don't know that. I don't know these actors, and it's not a cop out. I just made the decision not to engage with
not to know.
Oh, by the way, it should be noted that Tulsi Gabbard declared the other day that the era of regime change is over.
I don't know. And they also, you know, but
she was talking to.
Like, they use things like Tain de Aragua nonsense about how they're trafficking drugs and blowing up boats, supposedly at Tain de Aragua, which is patently absurd. So, do they have any real intelligence? I don't get a sense that they're differentiating among the different crises that they're looking at if this falls apart. Yeah. And I think that's a huge downside. I don't think there are any good solutions. I think there are ways, if you really got into the bowels of it, you could figure out what is less damaging. And again, you have to take into account the region. You can't just say what U.S. wants, what the Miami community wants. You really have to, and part of the reason all of this problem with Petro has arisen is because he's dealing with 2 million Venezuelan refugees that he has no capacity to deal with. And so I think that, you know, you have to be somewhat, if not sympathetic, aware that there are other factors at play in the region beyond your narrow interests.
I mean, there is a theory that a lot of this is being driven by Rubio because he sees the connections and links between the Venezuelans and the Cubans, and he somehow thinks, like, if we can do regime change in one place, it could spill over and finally get rid of
the dagger pointed at Antarctica.
That would make sense to me. I don't know what Secretary Rubio is really thinking or his inner circle is thinking, but I think that there is this long-seated desire that now is in the second or third generation to change the regime in Cuba, which, again, if you can't change a regime in Cuba, if you can't change a regime in Nicaragua, which has no natural resources to talk of, and we still can't, you know, deal with the Ortega and Murillo regime, then Venezuela is an entirely different animal. It actually has resources, weapons, a large population, enormous geographic territory. So it seems to me like we're sort of doing this ass backwards, right? If you really wanted to get at this problem, the starting point, which is much more valuable to the Russians and to the Chinese at this point, is Nicaragua. That's much more important in terms of their intelligence activities, their economic investments, and their interests in the region. Nicaragua is for both primarily Russia, but also for China, incredibly important, much more so than Venezuela. They view the Ortega regime as an enduring thing into the future, whether when he's gone, his sons will take over and his wife is there, et cetera. Maduro is an unstable, not very pleasant guy, and the regime's going to fall eventually in some fashion. So I think if you want to really start getting at the region in these problem sets, you would go Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, not Venezuela, and hope everything else falls down.
Wrong country. in other words. I can't imagine, it's hard to imagine Trump being Trump, him leaving the neighborhood without firing off a few guns. I mean, he's got the Gerald R. Ford arriving any moment. He's got missile guided destroyers. He's got all special forces. He's got to do something, you know.
Yeah, can he withdraw and bring everybody back without getting rid of Maduro?
I don't think so. I think it'd be tremendously, you know, humiliating if that were to happen, which leads me to believe, sir, if in my assessment, which is not based on anything but my knowledge of how things used to work and how things are on the ground there, I think if you start blowing up some of the ports and could somehow limit the collateral damage to civilians and really were precision striking, you could probably scare the people in the regime into becoming more flexible. I think that nobody wants, I don't think anybody until now, they didn't believe anyone was going to strike. They may not believe it now, and it may not happen. Right? That's the thing. With someone like the Trump administration, where there's no strategic thinking, a sort of gut reaction, I'm sure the military is pulling its hair out because they have scenarios planned out. And if with different things happening, they will do different things. But everyone's guessing at what might be ordered.
Scratching on the blackboard, why hasn't Maduro just delivered the head of the Tren de Agua to Trump? Just say, here, take him.
I think he offered at one point to do that or to go after the Tren de Aragua. I mean, part of the issue is, in reality, he doesn't have the Tren de Aragua leadership. A lot of the main leaders are in Colombia and elsewhere now. They've migrated out. I mean, the whole thing with Tren de Aragua has been that they have migrated out with the migrant communities and established themselves in those communities and then become much more criminalized and violent as they gain power in the diaspora communities outside. The prison and sort of where all of this started with Tren de Aragua is under state control. But does that mean anybody's left that has really had the command and control structure? Not necessarily, or not a lot of them.
So last bonus question for you. A year from now, will Maduro be in power?
I would guess that yes. I think that because all the options to bring him down are so bad, and we're so late in the game getting to this point of actually, especially on the financial front, of actually taking serious financial action that would cripple them. I think that there are with options so bad that is the temptation will be to blow up a few things and go and then say, okay, you know, they'll fall now and leave. That's my feeling of how it will go. I think if for some reason, I think the worst thing, and I think the Venezuelans know this, the worst thing they can do is begin shooting at American aircraft or ships or people, because that will provoke, you know, a God almighty wrath of God justification for coming down hard on them. And that would be really the end of them. They're probably smart enough to know that, and they will let these things pass. Every ship that, you know, the Southcom doesn't have a naval force of its own. It has to borrow ships from other fleets to have anything. So you can't keep this up indefinitely, which I'm sure also the Maduro regime is pretty conscious of. You can't have everyone highly mobilized in a non-kinetic theater when you have all these other things going on around the world and keep them there for, you know, months on end. And other fleets will want their ships back. They'll need their ships back to do stuff. And so I think that that's sort of the tension right now is, how long can we do this? What do we do to make ourselves less embarrassed when we leave? and how does it play out? I know those are all very unsatisfactory answers, but
illuminating discussion nonetheless.
What a fine mess.
Exactly. It's a fine mess. Exactly.
And then nothing that Trump does on the kinetic end or even economic warfare end is just going to make it better. There's no easy solution here, to say the least. And there it is. So yeah,
there it is.
Chuck,
it is.
Thanks for coming on the show with this uplifting message.
Sorry to throw more answers, but it was a lot of fun. Thank you. Good to see you guys.
We're not all that surprised, I must say. This is a mess. It's going to get worse before it gets better.
I'm afraid so.
Thanks
Thank
a lot.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform, and remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.